and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio, live and direct from Straight Stuff Studios. Actually, I'm fibbing already. We're not live tonight. We are pre-recorded. So, you can skip the call-in number this week as nobody will be here to answer the phone. So thank you for joining us tonight. I just want to, give a quick shout out to a couple of our friends, sponsors. I'm doing air quotes. You can't see it via radio, but just some friends of the show. I'd like to. We've got some friends. Bob Harper, who's with Double Take Band. They do a lot of cover music. Some good stuff. Everybody tells me it's a pretty fun party to go see them. But they've got a show coming up here. In just a few short days, they'll be playing at Keys Steak and Seafood Saturday, July 13th at 8:30. So go check them out. Their website, doubletakechicago.com. Some cool music. It starts playing Brick House. So if you have your speakers turned up real loud, it'll be a surprise. Maybe you'll forget. You'll just go check out the website. Brick. So go check them out. I'd also like to say a quick word about a really great mentoring program. It's a youth mentoring program called Sidekicks. You can check them out at sidekicksmentoring.org. It is, like I said, a youth mentoring program, no cost, volunteer program designed to offer structure and support for maintaining a healthy, sober lifestyle for teens. And, we're not your big brothers, big sisters, but, it's the same idea, but maybe a little bit more specialized. We're actually going to be in, we'll be doing a little advertising and candy distribution in the Fiesta Day Parade coming up here in just a few weeks. That's in McHenry, Illinois, Sunday, July 21st. I believe the parade starts at 11. So,
but we cannot throw the candy.
Oh, yeah, that's the distribution, not.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. No. No.
And the candy, but we cannot throw the candy.
Not to get off topic, but they have T-shirt cannons. How can they have T-shirt cannons and we can't throw Tootsie Rolls? What does that make any sense at all?
Not to me.
Not to me. So if you're gonna come out and see us at the parade, we'll be giving away some goodies. And we'll hand them gently to the, no throwing.
To the participants.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so that's all I got. I don't think I've introduced our host, Mr. Rick Atwater, everybody. Keeps this boat afloat.
Keeps this boat afloat.
Yes, sir.
Yes, we do. So welcome to Recovery Internet Radio and our show, Straight Stuff on Addictions. Tonight, our tag is Nurse Jack Loses It All. Not Nurse Jackie.
No, be clear here.
I want to make that clear.
Very clear.
And if anybody knows if there's a theme song to the Nurse Jackie show, go to our website and let us know about it. Because I can't. Is there a theme song? I can't.
I'm sure. Whatever the music starts up.
Okay.
That website is recoveryinternetradio.com.
Every Sunday night at 8, and we're glad that you can join us tonight. Thanks to Chris, who does our engineering. And, so you can reach us, you can tweet us at Rick Atwater, you can contact us via our website, recoveryinternetradio.com, and that is...
recoveryinternetradio.com, and our Facebook at Recovery Internet Radio. I mean, we try to keep it simple.
Yeah. Keep it the same. Yeah. And Recovery Internet Radio, you can listen to us live on Recovery Internet Radio, or the most current show live, or... You can also hear us. All the archive shows are there as well.
Yeah, I think most of our fans. Can I call them fans? Do we have fans?
I call them listeners.
Listeners.
You call them fans.
Either or.
I think some of our listeners might be fans.
Audience members.
Okay, either.
For those of you listening, if you hear the show on a weekly basis, then you already know this. But if you're new, then check out recoveryinternetradio.com, and you can also download us as a podcast. So it just automatically will fly magically into your iDevice every week, and you can hear our newest episode. So that's always nice too.
All right, great. So you can get to us a lot of ways. So let's get us started. And Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And we know you're from out of state.
Yes, sir.
From a state that shall remain nameless at this time. But it's a good state.
It is. It's a big one.
It's a big one.
One of the bigger states?
One of the bigger ones.
Okay.
Yes, I love Vermont. Anyway, so my first question to you is kind of like I want to set the stage a little bit. So we talked about, you know, some of the things I wanted to ask, and you know, I know by the title of the show, you know, people will figure out you're a nurse.
Right.
So, but I think it's, you know, and we're here talking about chemical dependency, about addiction. And so I think a lot of times people make the assumption that, you know, professionals have everything all put together and don't have any problems and, you know, whatnot. So we're kind of here to talk a little bit about the stereotypical end of things. But, well, just maybe a little bit about yourself as far as what your upbringing was like. What was it like for you when you were a kid? What were you like? Were you an altar boy?
I was. interesting what you ask. I was actually born in a small town in Pennsylvania, and have a younger sister, and my upbringing was pretty normal.
Mm-hmm.
Two parents that tried their hardest to make sure we had everything we needed within their means. I always felt a little different. I didn't understand that growing up, but I always felt different than the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
For a little while, I thought it was because I was gay, but...
Mm-hmm.
No, I was just different.
Darn.
Darn.
Yeah. Or it could be both, whatever. You
right.
Know, you're just different. Yeah. So you were you, would you have considered yourself a good kid?
Very. Yeah. Straight A's.
Really?
Yes. Straight A's. Class president. Homecoming king. My dad was a high school football coach, so I had to play. I got my butt kicked every day, but another story, another time.
Yeah. So you were like, and football in Pennsylvania is pretty serious.
It's big stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you would consider yourself having had a normal childhood. Were there any? Would looking back on it, would you say that there was any things that were hints to you of what was to come for you?
Looking back, yeah. I mean, it's very interesting because the first time I was ever drunk with alcohol poisoning, I was 4.
Holy cow.
Yes. And that sounds different than a normal childhood, but I was at a wedding. And
did you get a hold of somebody's hooch?
No, there was a fuzzy navel fountain. And I thought it was punch.
Wow.
And I was able to crawl up on a chair and get punch all night long.
And I should know what a fuzzy navel is.
It's kind of like a chocolate fountain, but the little lion heads have fuzzy navels popping out.
Which would have been delicious. I think a fuzzy navel is basically like peach schnapps and orange juice
and
something on
it. To a kid, it tastes phenomenal.
I bet it was delicious.
Fuzzy navel fountain. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, but that doesn't sound normal to me right there. But you know,
I have told my mom that made me gay. But
yeah.
Anyway.
All right, so you're drinking out of a fuzzy navel fountain, thinking it's punch, and you get alcohol, but you have to go to the hospital, the whole deal.
Yeah. Everybody was telling my folks, like looking back, that I was such a riot because I was dancing and I was having a good time, and everybody just thought I was a riot at age 4, drunk. And then my mom realized what I was doing, and later that night I kept getting sicker and sicker, and I was vomiting, and next thing you know I was in the ER with an IV and all the stuff they do to adults, but on a kid size.
Looking back on it, that was. A little different, yeah. That was a little different. What would be any other things that were warning signs to you?
I got excited watching people do cocaine on television in high school. Like I had never done cocaine, but like I would see people do it.
You're still in the good
the good boy phase, but it just looked like they were having fun. Like
it looked good to you.
It looked good, yeah. And I never tried it, but it looked good. Interesting.
Did you end up doing cocaine?
Yeah, as soon as I left home. I would say probably it took 3-4 days. Yeah. At college. Before,
you really put it off.
I waited a long time. But I was in college and probably got to college and I had a couple drinks the first couple nights, and then on night number three, there was cocaine. And I was like, I've been waiting for this for a very long time.
So, all right. So, and any other? So, once you got to college, then that's where things started to happen.
Yeah, things started. I thought I was normal because I was getting drunk a lot in college.
And that's what everybody else was doing.
That's what everybody else was doing.
At least everybody else, you, yeah.
But they were going to class.
Oh.
I mean, I didn't go to class hardly ever. And my first degree is in social work, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I got it, to be honest. I mean, really. I mean, because I didn't go to class much at all.
Just naturally smart, maybe?
No.
I don't know.
I mean, I had good friends. I guess that's the best way to say it. Like good friends that were in my major who like made sure that I would get there on test day. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was always very lucky. I had somebody looking out for me a lot.
And that could be, and I guess we could talk about that as a good thing or as a not so good thing as time goes on.
Correct.
Right. But it sounds like you were, well, what were you doing with your time when you were in class?
I was sleeping until about 3, getting up, partying. After my freshman year, everybody knew I was gay, so, and my family and I had a very difficult time with that, with my coming out process. We stopped talking and et cetera.
Was that at that time?
That was my freshman year in college.
Yeah.
It's quite funny because my mom actually called me and asked me a bunch of questions because she was concerned for some reason. She asked me, are you doing poorly in school? I said, I don't know. I didn't want to say yes to that. But the rest of the time I was very honest because she said, well, are you depressed? And I said, probably a little. She said, are you drinking too much? I said, yes. She said, are you doing a lot of drugs? And I said, no, I can't afford them. Then she asked me if I was gay. And I said, I think so.
Yeah.
And
that's what, and it was the last question that,
mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that, you know, you were drinking too much, or it wasn't that.
She would have been okay with that. At that point in time.
At that point in time
in my life, yes, she would have been okay with that.
A little bit?
Yeah. A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Over time. But at that point, and so you and your family kind of broke off there?
Yes.
And I know we talked about this, I think we were talking yesterday about it a little bit, but you that was something that was, I don't want to say trigger, but that was a thought that you had in your head that rejection was the reason?
Well, their rejection it made me angry, first of all, and second of all, it gave me a reason to drink and use. I thought, well, fine, if they're not going to approve of the lifestyle, I'll show them. Kind of
right.
That
you thought that lifestyle was bad.
Wait till you see this. So I'm probably 2 weeks later, I was dancing in a nightclub, and I did that for the rest of the time in school, and the drug use started and got really bad there because there was a coke phase, a ecstasy, GHB, ketamine phase before the crystal meth phase. Wow, that sounds rough. And I was dancing in a nightclub and selling ecstasy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a good salesperson because I did more than I sold.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't keep the product.
No.
Keep slipping through the fingers.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, would you say, well, so and somehow or another, you're still going to school through all this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I graduated, and my first job after social work school.
You go to like a state school or a
Private school.
Private school.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I just took out more loans. And I actually had the fortunate opportunity to do a, not necessarily study abroad, but there was an opportunity to do social work internships through NYU in New York City. So I did 2 years in New York, and I say did 2 years, not in prison, but I did 2 years in New York, don't remember much. But,
yeah, we'll get to that part of the story later.
And then my first job was outside of D.C., more toward Baltimore in the Silver Spring area.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a job as a bachelor's level social worker doing substance abuse evaluations in the emergency room.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
Wow. And what phase were we in at that point?
I was still partying.
Yeah.
I still worked in a nightclub.
I wondered which one, because we did the ketamine, GHB, phase, we did the coke phase, we did the meth phase.
I was probably back to the ketamine, ecstasy, GHB group, because I just did it on the weekend.
And it's, well, you got to control this stuff somehow.
I know. I mean, plus, who wants to be high on ecstasy all week long, you know?
Yeah, really. I mean, so you just went rolling into the ER.
Exactly. Yeah. No, and I was sent home then already by supervisors.
We're joking around, but were you really just doing it on the weekends, or were you like doing other things during the week?
Well, my weekend consisted of Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and maybe a little Monday morning. So,
So your weekend's like half a week.
Yeah. But I work 12-hour shifts, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
let me ask you this.
Uh-huh.
Did the, I just wanted to step back to the clubs and the dancing and the drugs. Because you hear, and I think I would think, or I would picture that would be a place where a lot of drugs would be available.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you hear, and you hear, you know, frankly, people taking a lot of drugs because they, it's actually a hard thing to do self-esteem-wise that you don't maybe.
A young person coming out in the gay community? Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
It's a connection, I think.
Yeah.
And plus, I said this before, but I think with all the guilt and the shame that comes from, came to me from coming out being different and all that other thing,
right.
The drug helped with some of the guilt and shame, lowered inhibitions, and especially crystal meth eventually, I mean, because...
Right.
Even though the guilt and shame should have been getting better, it kept getting worse, which I thought still was because I was gay, but it was more addiction.
Yeah.
Between that and my later 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, but that I can see where that would be confusing. And you were and when you were doing that, you were that was early, and you had just come out. Really,
yes.
It was just shortly after you had come out. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a. They call them circuit parties in the gay world,
mm-hmm.
which are huge parties, but they're at very lavish locations usually. And everybody that I was partying with, doing drugs with, was older, could afford to take these huge trips,
mm-hmm.
and they were lawyers, doctors,
mm-hmm.
successful people, and so I just assumed everybody did it.
I
mean, it just seemed like it was just part of the lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing else to the lifestyle in my head.
Yeah, it's all you knew.
It's all I knew.
Yeah, and then so all right. So then we fast forward. We spent 2 years in New York doing your internship, and then now we're in Baltimore, and we're doing substance abuse evaluation in the ER. So
God.
How did you get the job? I mean, like I understand how that can happen, but I just wondered, like, did you have an interest at some level?
No, not at all.
It just came along.
They paid the most out of everything else I was offered.
Really?
Yeah. And they were doing
the, that was $15 an hour, probably.
I think it was. Maybe it was $14.25, and then I bartered
then
for $15.
Then you bumped it up. Yeah.
It was big money. The schedule was conducive to the lifestyle.
I get you. Okay.
To still work in a nightclub on the weekends or go to circuit parties for a long weekend and recover a little bit before coming into work.
Any inkling yet that this is causing a problem, or is it just to you just a normal, we're just doing normal stuff still?
Normal stuff, but I still thought it was normal stuff. However, I noticed that my straight friends
mm-hmm.
from college and who kind of were starting to grow up a little bit, and
mm-hmm.
grow up in whose eyes, well, I don't know, but grow up, like start families or take on big jobs and things like that, and,
mm-hmm.
or going to grad school, we started losing contact because I was always messed up.
Yeah. Anybody ever say anything to you?
Yeah, several. Several.
Like those type of people that were straightening up or some of your less straight friends? I mean straight in the perspective of drugs and alcohol. I don't mean sexual straight.
Mm-hmm.
Any of your less drug-related friends said something? Did any of your drug-related friends say anything?
I was always the fun one. I mean, I guess
life of the party.
The life of the party.
So
yeah.
They always wanted you there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially because I usually had the ecstasy too.
Well, you were a big time, and you had the drugs. I would say, you know,
yeah.
So they're going to want you there. So they're not going to be saying anything about your drug use, is what you're saying. The only reason I ask that is because, like, when your druggy friends tell you you've got a problem, then you really know that things are going south.
That came after I became a nurse.
Okay, so
it's coming, yeah, it's coming,
right, coming,
but not
okay.
yet.
Okay. All right, so, and then I threw a question in about, you know, moral deterioration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but what I was, thinking about when I said that was, I know a little bit about your story as a nurse, so like having to do with sort of scamming and that sort of mm-hmm. stuff. Was that going on prior to that part of your story, you know, like when you were dealing or when you were, you know, did you notice any difference in
my moral?
Were,
oh, yeah.
How you were morally with people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, back to the guilt and shame thing. I mean, I just, if you put drugs, I never thought I'd be doing drugs every weekend growing up. You know what I mean? So
yeah, almost like the furthest thing from your mind or the furthest thing from anybody's expectations.
Well, I thought I would be leaving college and either going to law school or med school. You know what I mean? Growing up, that was
my
goal. I wanted to help people and all that
mm-hmm.
that jazz, not doing drugs on the weekend and not caring mm-hmm. how I got them. Or
and isn't it interesting that, you know, by the end of a week or so with the listens that we're going to have, you're going to probably give or take a thousand or more people are going to hear your story, and you will be helping people.
Yeah,
it's crazy. We weren't thinking that, were we?
No, no, not at all. Not at the time, especially.
Not at the time.
And I mean, like, with first of all, the drugs. Second of all, selling drugs. I mean, because
mm-hmm.
that's another little level.
It's another
level. Step down.
Sure.
The sexual escapades of the drug use of circuit scene and
sure.
And the gay community at the time
mm-hmm.
was definitely not something that I really grew up wanting in terms of a relationship, because I just wanted a relationship that was normal,
yeah.
and none of that was normal. Like
right.
It wasn't healthy,
right?
Yeah, at all.
Yeah, and yet, so that's I guess how that deterioration works is that you know in some part of you that it's not. Which, you know, the scamming, the drugs, whatever, the sexual stuff, and you know it's not right, but there it is, you know, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess that contributes to the guilt and shame stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, what I thought was helping the guilt and shame, the drugs,
mm-hmm.
and me allowed to act sexually was actually making it worse.
Did you think other people were judging you?
If they were judging me, I thought they were jealous. Does that make sense? Tore up from the floor up, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
I thought they were jealous. It's like, yeah, whatever.
were you judging you?
I didn't care at that point in time. Like, I was
okay.
already past the point of caring, I think.
Okay.
By the phase we were talking about.
We're talking the ER substance abuse. How long did that last? How long were you there?
I was there long enough to go through nursing school.
Oh, you were there the whole time. Did they pay for it?
They paid for part of it.
Yeah?
Yeah, they paid for part of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good thing about hospitals if they,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yep.
if you can stay up
for it. I paid for it up front, and then they reimburse
part of it.
And
they reimburse you a certain amount?
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
a good thing.
Very much so.
Yeah, so you were, how long did it take you, 4 years?
Three, because I already had a bachelor's degree, so.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. All right. So you were there for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Did...
I actually ended up staying there as a nurse for a little while.
Oh, okay.
So, and I was actually on their staff for 9 years total, social worker and a nurse,
mm-hmm.
Even though I worked at another hospital in D.C. Full-time.
Like also? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I'm registry, agency, okay. those types of things.
I get you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice from the time that you were, you know, like while you were going to nursing school,
mm-hmm.
did you notice, was there a did it get worse?
Well, before I got to nursing school, that's when the crystal meth started. And
Why do you think it started?
It was kind of like what was taking on the gay community at the time. I would say mid-90s, it was
mm-hmm.
kind of an emergence of crystal meth,
mm-hmm.
from what my experience was anyway,
yeah.
In the community, and the circuit parties used to be just ecstasy, ketamine, maybe some GHB, but meth started coming around. And I swore I would never do meth, but that lasted about 6 months or something.
Why did
like
you swear you would never do meth?
I don't know. It just seemed like it was closer to the gutter. It wasn't very as classy.
And in fact, it was.
It was. It definitely was.
Yeah, but so. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that kind of goes along with that deteriorating. You know, mm-hmm. making promises to yourself that you don't keep, and then feeling like shit about yourself because mm-hmm. you didn't keep the promise. And you know, did you have any inkling yet of what was wrong with you?
No. And
still thought it was because you were gay?
Yeah. I mean, I still thought it was because I was gay or, I don't know. I stopped thinking about it, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah, because you just said you didn't care much anymore.
Mm-mm.
You're doing what you're doing.
And, it's weird because, I would say, there's no such thing as social Crystal Matthews, but I thought I was doing it. I would use other drugs and mostly meth on the weekends. So I thought I was using socially. However, during the week when I...
You're still doing the 4.5-day weekends?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the weeks, well, yes. And with school, the school was lumped mostly to those days as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was cut my schedule a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But during the week, I couldn't do meth during the week because I had to work and everything else. So I just did a couple Adderall a day. Same damn drug. But
right. Just to keep you moving.
Just to keep me moving and keep me focused. That's what that was my excuse, to keep me focused.
Right. How'd you get the Adderall?
I was working with a
psychiatrist. I mean, I assume you don't have ADHD.
No, but... well, some days, but... I have GADD, that's what I call it.
Yeah.
I actually worked a little bit helping a psychiatrist that was at the hospital.
Yeah.
And she, I actually helped her with her hydroponic pot garden in addition to her practice. And she just said, oh, yeah, you need some Adderall and some Xanax and some Clonabin. So she was just giving me drugs at that point in time, like scripts for whatever I wanted.
Some people would find that. Like
morally
almost like sacrilegious that she was like giving you drugs and growing mm-hmm. pot and but that's just
fascinating because she would write a script for Adderall for it was like 90 tablets a month of the extended release mm-hmm. 30 milligrams extended release. You don't need 90 milligrams of extended release Adderall a day. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But she would write it that amount so I would give her half.
Oh, I get you. So it would be in your, and if any questions ever came up, it would be in your, the script would be
in my name.
In your name, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I get it.
Yeah.
So yeah. Well, and like it says in the little blurb that I send out to people to advertise the show, you know, it's an equal opportunity disease.
Mm-hmm.
So any judgment that, you know, whether that doctor knew that was right or wrong, or you know, that might not have had anything to do. If she had the illness herself, that wouldn't be a factor. We don't know if she did or she didn't, but...
You're not supposed to say whether or not somebody had the disease, but she had it.
Well, you know...
You shouldn't, but because you're in that line of work, but I'll say
but
she did.
But here it is. And so... and, you know, but I think people think that, you know, somehow or another, doctors, nurses... social workers are above that, or what do they think they're above it, or what do they?
They think they should know better.
They should know better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and they tell you in nursing school and medical school, and probably law school too, that it's probably the highest rate of substance abuse profession.
Yeah,
and they tell you that in the beginning.
Yeah, and everybody thinks we're too smart; it won't happen to us.
Yep, they tell you that in the beginning, that you think we're too smart, it's going to happen to us, and then they give, in medical schools, probably about a day and a half of substance abuse education to training physicians,
mm-hmm.
and in nursing school, I think we got 2 lectures on addiction.
Oh. Kind That's of, amazing to me.
Yeah.
So they know, statistically, and they tell you, that this is a big, common problem. We're not going to tell you anything more about it, other than be aware that you might have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, good luck.
In social work school, it was a day, actually. Uh-huh. Isn't that wild?
I was just trying to think. I actually, because, you know, my education is as a counselor, and I don't think, I mean, I don't think there was any,
mm-hmm.
not zero.
Yeah.
Of course, it was, you know, a while ago, so,
mm-hmm.
but still, that, like zero for a guy who's going to go into
counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I think the nursing instructors that I had would be like, and then we get to this. And like it was already
something they had to do.
They had to deal with, and they all had a story about these drug seekers, patients that wanted opiates or this or that, and how annoying they were. And yes, I mean, the prejudice start there.
It wasn't about, they didn't have like a recovering social worker or nurse come in and talk.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
A group about what it was really like.
No, they had some nurse who had, who was teaching the class that would be like,
who had to do that section.
Had to do that section, and we got stories shared with us about the issues they had dealing with a drug addicted patient that was a pain in the neck.
Right. And I think, you know, I mean, this totally, you know, fits with the things I've seen, you know, that people with drug problems going to, you know, trying to get admitted to the ER, mm-hmm. not to get drugs, but to get off drugs,
mm-hmm.
have to learn certain techniques to get into the hospital through the nursing staff. They have to say they're suicidal to get admitted.
Or homicidal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In order to get admitted for treatment,
mm-hmm.
for drug problems.
Yep.
Now, there are those who go there and are drug seekers. I mean, there's no...
Sure. And then they're not even transferred to a treatment center. They're transferred to an acute psych hospital,
usually.
Where they have to deal with... be on a unit with people doing the Thorazine shuffle that can't even say their name because they have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
It's extreme,
and
still the wrong environment. You
right.
know, it's not a drug and alcohol-focused treatment center. They may have an AA meeting.
Right. Well, I think we'll take, if you don't mind here, we'll take a short breather,
mm-hmm.
and we'll come back, and we'll talk about kind of, we'll finish, We'll get to the stuff that we can talk about how you got to the point where you finally
okay.
recognize the need to recover, and then some time talking about your recovery.
Awesome.
If that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate that, and thanks for listening. We'll be right back with you. Welcome back to Recovery Internet Radio. If you're just joining us, we've been having quite the conversation so far. You can reach us anytime at recoveryinternetradio.com and check out this show or any of our archived episodes. I'd say call in, but we're pre-recording here, so
right.
don't call in this week if you're dying to ask any questions. We won't answer the phone. So let's get right back to it, and I hope you've been enjoying the show. Thanks for coming back.
Okay, we're back, and so I guess one of the questions, so what I kind of want to do, like I sort of said at the end of our first segment there, sort of get to the end of the story, how we, you know, the crash and burn part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So so you're going to nursing school and doing meth on the weekends. That's basically where we got to. And then what?
And then, in a nutshell, that pretty much continued for the rest of my 20s. I got into, like, partying on the weekend.
Did meth help you study?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. There were days in nursing school that I swore I'd never do meth during the week, that I did a little bit. You know what I mean? But, yeah, it did help me study. I mean, and it was able to keep me up late to get all the work done. Like,
right.
The actual studying, getting
sure.
through, and
mm-hmm.
just to get
the
it done.
Reading and all that stuff.
Yeah.
How about the comprehension part?
Well, I thought I was doing everything good, and I thought I was, hell, I did some things twice because I was that speedy, but yeah, it helped.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah, because I think that's why some people do it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I know some kids, you know, take Adderall
mm-hmm.
specifically because they think it's a academic enhancement drug, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Sure.
And then they also take, you know, I don't know if they are actually using methamphetamine as,
right.
You know, because that's a little bit rougher around the edges. But
never know what you're going to get.
You never know what you're going to get cooked in somebody's
A lot of parents think Adderall will help their children do better in school as well.
Yeah.
In my experience,
yeah. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right about that.
Mm-hmm.
Were you still dabbling with the Adderall along
the
way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had that until I got to...
That you could do during the week, right? Oh, okay.
That I could do at work.
All right. How was your drinking? We never even talked about that. Were you much of a drinker?
I didn't think I was until rehab, and then I looking back, all of the trouble I got into at that point in time in my life, there was alcohol involved.
Okay. Yeah.
And I still had reservations even the first 2 years of sobriety with alcohol because I ended up drinking after several years of sober.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get to that later, I guess.
Yeah.
The meth and party scene was on the weekends, and I got into a relationship with a physician.
Mm-hmm.
So life seemed to be going okay, and the partying got a little bit less
mm-hmm.
While we were together. And when we broke up, that's when I started using intravenous drugs.
Okay.
And that was mostly meth in the beginning.
Yeah.
I hurt my back. I hurt my back. And
his last words.
Yeah, I hurt my back.
I've heard him before.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
What's that? I hurt my back.
And yeah.
And kind of that
then it's opiate painkillers, right?
Uh-huh.
Yep. And the kicker was, is physician/nurse/heal-thyself, I had just moved to the big state, and... my health insurance had not kicked in yet.
Hmm.
So I hurt my back, and I needed to continue to work at a new, until my health, and I couldn't, I just didn't have the money yet to go see somebody, get x-rays taken, all that other jazz.
Yeah.
So I grabbed some drugs from the hospital. So I didn't get opiates from anybody else. I grabbed them myself. I just took a little extra that was
mm-hmm.
left that I didn't have to give to a patient,
mm-hmm.
put it in my pocket, took it home and used it.
Mm-hmm. Bikes or what were they?
No, Dilaudid.
Dilaudid.
I went straight for the big one.
Okay,
yep.
So why bother? Well, yeah, let's not mess with it. And for those who might not know what Dilaudid is?
It is a opiate painkiller. If heroin and morphine are kind of similar in terms of their effects, Dilaudid is 8 to 10 times stronger than morphine.
Okay.
And fentanyl is a little stronger, which I graduated to.
And fentanyl is what they use for, like, a lot of times cancer, bone cancer type people. Or
yes, Dilaudid
people.
And fentanyl, they're usually used for folks that have, like, horrific cancers and are actively dying. Because, well, actually, most hospice patients are getting morphine. These are like when morphine doesn't work, and
that's what you get is Dilaudid or fentanyl. And the reason why they do that last is because they're highly addictive, and mm-hmm. but at that point it doesn't really matter. They can increase the dosage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And after the relationship ended and I started doing some IV crystal meth use, hurt my back, it was interesting because I was having a lot of emotional things going on, and the Dilaudid turned off the emotions as well.
Yeah.
Conveniently, at the same time as it turned off the physical pain.
Right. What took you from the, where did we get the IV, where did we go to the IV Matthews.
After we broke up, it was a random sexual experience that the guy had the needle and
just started.
What the hell situation?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So it goes back to the I don't care thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are you now that you're using needles? Are you getting it yet that you have a problem?
Well, at first. I went down pretty quick once I started using needles.
Because,
I didn't stop the meth, and I didn't stop, and the opiates kind of took off, and that combination to me.
And you were using the opiates IV, too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The needle with the meth thing and the opiate thing started around the same time, so I didn't see a problem with needle with meth. And
right.
And
it would be natural to use a needle to...
To a nurse.
Yeah.
For
the pain medication, and so...
And it's faster, it works more efficiently, you can titrate it. It's all going on in my head.
Yeah, right.
But, the kicker with the needle, that's when my major not yet started. Like, that's when I noticed something, like, well, I'd never use a needle and I crossed that line. And then to this point, I had not ever stolen drugs from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I had not been impaired to the point of dangerous at work.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted a few weeks that I wouldn't use at work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a few weeks.
Yeah, that's not long.
That's not long, no.
And up till now, you've pretty much crossed most of the lines you said you weren't going to cross.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And my background is emergency room and trauma, so I was taking care of all age patients.
Yeah.
Infants through adults.
Yep.
And the sickest of patients. I mean, then they're
right. Crisis.
Cut in half and from a car accident. You know what I mean? And they're mm-hmm. they're pretty sick. And in that environment, I had unlimited access to the amount of narcotics. Because it's a place where you use those heavy-duty painkillers. And there's not... there's a little less restrictions on how you get them.
Right.
Because you don't... The patients aren't in the computer when they're coming off of an ambulance and they need drugs. So there's less monitoring.
Of the use of the drugs.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And you were telling me in the ICU it's different because... The
physician has to have an order.
The order, and then the amount of drugs can be compared to the order.
Yes.
But in the ER, it's just use it as you need it.
Use it as you need it, and it's so busy usually that the nurses are writing the physician's orders for them. So, you can make it happen however. That sounds dangerous to y'all out there, but trust me, if a nurse wants drugs, they can get them.
It's true. And the other question I had for you, which would be, I'm sure other people would scare people as well, but do you think you were the only one in the ER that was doing that?
No. I shared with you last night that when I got in trouble, three other nurses at the same time in the same place also were found out within the same week.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the point isn't to, demonize the nurses for stealing drugs. The point mm-hmm. is to recognize... You have an illness. You have a disease called chemical dependency, and that not recognizing that is the outcome of not recognizing that
Absolutely. Sooner
and not having a better attitude. Mm-hmm. The profession having a better attitude and a more proactive attitude towards it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what'll make it more safe. Not judging people after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But we don't, you know, so, and maybe if there's anything that we do here tonight when we talk about this, it's like, this is real, dudes. This is what happens. This is what really happens. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you working in a big city hospital at this point?
Oh, yeah.
So it was rock and roll?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was about 100-bed emergency room.
So okay, so that's
a big place. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the biggest in the country.
All right, so what finally happens to you when you, so you're stealing drugs, you're stealing more drugs.
You're still doing the drugs that I was buying.
You're doing the drugs you were buying, you're doing the drugs that you were stealing, and then you got caught.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, I didn't know that I was definitely hooked on the opiates in the beginning. But then, I couldn't get out of bed unless I had opiates. I mean, because I was in withdrawal.
You're sick, yeah.
Yeah, after a couple hours, you're dope sick, as mm-hmm. everybody uses. And, I mean, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, all that jazz. And it's hard to work with that, so I started using at work.
So you didn't know you were addicted to, and yet you're dope sick.
Uh-huh, and I'm picking up overtime because I needed to not necessarily get more money. It was because that was more time to get free drugs, because you're not paying for them if you have unlimited access in,
right.
at work. I mean, that's
right.
a no-brainer. I mean, you have to be at work so many hours a week.
So in other words, now you're working
more.
You're working more to get more drugs, not to get more money.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Did you know that?
No, I needed money because that's in my head. I needed money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back on it as we talk about this, isn't that amazing? Here's a guy who's shooting meth, and broken pretty much every promise that he's made to himself so
mm-hmm.
far.
Uh-huh.
You got a good person underneath, but completely compromised in a lot of ways.
And I mean,
and now stealing and breaking promises that way to himself.
Impaired taking care of infants.
Impaired and taking care of infants.
Infants
yeah.
and children and adults.
Which
and, yeah.
in you would never do if you were who you are.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And yet, you still don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I think people don't understand, is that that's how deeply, it's not a lie.
Yeah.
It's you're fooling yourself. You're able to fool yourself because of the nature of the disease.
Mm-hmm. So I was definitely a risk to the public.
Sure.
Then I got arrested.
Is that hard to say?
That I was a threat to the public?
Yeah.
It isn't now.
It
was when I was first told that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And I can imagine.
Because mm-hmm, I was a good nurse in my head.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine you are a good nurse.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to blow my own horn, but...
Yeah, you know what you're doing.
I know what I'm doing.
You know how to take care of people.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time,
mm-hmm.
you were a risk. So they come to you and they tell you you're a risk?
Well, I got arrested for an evading arrest with a motor vehicle charge. I had was using meth and opiates and threw GHB into the mix just because, I don't know, I
mm-hmm.
needed to and decided to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I drove the wrong way up the tollway. O.J. Simpson style.
Mm-hmm.
So I got arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And when they pulled me over, I thought I was getting a DUI.
mm-hmm.
No. I thought I was getting a DUI, and then they told me I was being charged with a felony evading arrest with a motor vehicle. And that was a doozy. That's the time that I got mad at the cops. And
mm-hmm. That's when you urinated in the squad car?
I urinated in the squad car, and I'm still a little proud of that, but anyway. Another story, another time.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, I ended up in jail, got bailed out.
How could you get arrested for evading if they haven't tried to pull you over yet? Or did they?
Well, they spent several minutes following me with the lights on.
Oh, okay.
I didn't pull over.
So that's the evading part.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah. Anyway.
So you thought it was a UFO, or?
Even because they had a tape of the whole situation, I still don't believe they were following me for 3 minutes. But anyway. I'm joking.
No, okay. All right. Yeah.
But yeah, so I got in trouble there. And the charge was reduced to a misdemeanor. I was put on probation. And then right after that is when I actually fell asleep at work. And I came into work on my day off. I was messed up, and I laid down in the staff lounge, actually on a table, and some staff members found me, and it wasn't even my day to work, because I came in for drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me to do a urine sample, and they actually sent me home first. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They sent me home, and then they called me to come back and do a urine sample. And I lived above a gym where I was, so I went downstairs to the gym, and I was freaking out because I needed to go give them a urine sample. And I saw somebody I knew, and I'm like, "Hey, are you clean?" They were like, "What?" I'm like, "Have you drank or done drugs recently?" And I said, "No." He's like, "No." And I knew of him. I didn't know him well, but I gave him $20 to piss in a... Can I say that on here?
Oh, yeah.
piss in a Coke can for me, and I used his urine. I put it in my... put it in a urine sample container, hid it in my clothes, and used his urine to pass the drug screen.
And did it work?
It worked.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
That is wild.
Paying people for their urine, and I still didn't have a problem in my
life. That's right.
Obviously not. You passed the drug test?
I know.
Okay.
Where's the problem?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so we get past that one.
We get past that one, but they decided that they were going to do random drug screens on me at work.
So you were under suspicion at that point?
I was under suspicion.
Mm-hmm. Did they think you were ripping them off, or did they just think you were taking them?
They just weren't sure. They just wanted to put me on a random drug testing program.
Tighten up the leash a little bit,
Then they started. They actually ran a report from the medication system,
mm-hmm.
and discovered that there was a lot of discrepancies of what I took out of the drug dispensing machine,
mm-hmm.
versus what was ordered in my patient's charts.
Right.
So there was either patients not getting drugs that I was pulling, or I was taking drugs for some other reason.
Right.
And that's one of two reasons. It's either I'm selling them,
mm-hmm.
or I'm doing them.
Right.
And of course you admit to doing them, because if you're taking them to sell them, that's a whole other ballgame.
Yeah, now it's bad enough, but
mm-hmm.
yeah.
So they took me upstairs to a treatment program at the same hospital, and enrolled me in the day program there. And I did 2 weeks and some odd days before going back to work, and I would go to treatment in the morning, same hospital, walk downstairs, and then work a 12-hour shift in the emergency room.
And then go home and get high?
And then go home and get high.
Yeah.
That's a busy day.
Yeah.
It was very busy.
Well, you were probably not getting high while you were in treatment, because they were probably testing you.
Oh, I was.
Oh, you were?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you just didn't care at that point, or you just didn't think they would catch you?
I hadn't seen them drug test anyone.
Oh, okay.
In treatment at that point in time.
All right.
And it's fascinating, because the hospital was actually in the process of debating whether or not they still needed this treatment program. And it closed. I was their last patient. I shouldn't say that on the radio, but I was their last client when they shut it down.
Really?
Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is. So, yeah.
So the hospital that sent me to this treatment program got rid of the treatment program because they didn't think...
They don't think it was...
successful or whatever.
Right, but that's the one they put you in.
That's the one they put me in.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. and as it turns out, it wasn't particularly successful for you. So then you're still using... Still using, working,
and I overdosed. Because I had a little bit of time clean.
Yeah.
I told you about that earlier.
Yeah.
2 weeks or something like that. Right. It was very shortly thereafter, when I got back to work, that I overdosed at work on opiates. And security found me in a bathroom,
mm-hmm.
While I was on the clock,
mm-hmm.
passed out, needle in my arm, bleeding all over the place. And every hospital I worked in, there's always every month or so you hear about the anesthesiologist that was found with a needle in his arm in the bathroom and dead or something. I mean, it's incredible how frequently it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But
we don't hear about
you
that.
Don't hear about
you
it.
You hear about that about as often as you hear about drunk pilots.
Yes, exactly.
You know, there's plenty of drunk pilots. You know, no offense, fellas, but you know, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and I know it, but you know, and a lot of recovering pilots, quite frankly, too.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't hear much about that.
Right.
You know. And we scare the public, right?
Exactly.
And then the public's idea then is that that pilots don't have problems.
Exactly.
Or nurses don't have problems. Mm-hmm. And so I guess in that way we kind of participate in our own, denial system, because if we don't tell people, and thank God we're doing this, because if we don't tell people, how are they going to know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what happened after you OD? And tell people what you mean, because some people think, OD, well, then that means dead.
No, I took too much and I went unconscious.
Yeah.
Went unconscious.
Was it opiates that
it was
did it?
Opiates, yeah. So my breathing was shallowed. I woke up and I was at the ER where I worked, being treated for an overdose.
In the ER where you worked?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the first time.
Did you, when you first opened your eyes, the face that you saw, did you know it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
One of your fellow nurses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you embarrassed?
She was really, she was very judgmental and very, she was very angry that I would do that, first of all. Second of all, she just, you could tell that she was annoyed that it was another drug addict in one of her rooms.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So.
And so I don't know. I just kind of that kind of stuff.
So you went from a fellow nurse to another bothersome drug addict.
I went from being really her mentor to be a drug addict. Yeah.
From her mentor.
From her mentor. Yeah.
To being a drug addict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was fired at that point in time. Yeah. And I knew I was in trouble at the come this point. I knew I was in trouble. And so I contacted the nursing board and voluntarily offered to participate in a drug diversion program that treats impaired nurses.
Right.
And I was turned down. I was turned down because I had been arrested. Which kind of threw me. Looking back, it's like, okay, well.
That would be the reason why. No,
it was because I was arrested that they could not enroll me in the treatment program for nurses.
Okay.
And at this point in time, I still thought that the board, that be the medical board, the pharmacy board, the nursing board, and they're a bunch of professionals who manage and regulate the profession.
And that's at the state level?
State level.
Mm-hmm.
I had the wrong idea in my head. And I thought they were there to protect the nurses and the physicians and the pharmacists. No, they are there to protect the public, not the practitioners. So I think a lot of healthcare workers don't realize that until they're in trouble with the board.
Yeah. Okay. And
it's not a bad thing. That's their role. Their role is to protect the public.
It's just you misunderstood that.
Yeah, because nobody ever tells
you. If you were to do it again, what would you do? You would go to your employee assistance program what would you do? What would you
seek? Try to do it without involving your place of employment or the board first.
Right.
Because what happened was they said no to that, so I kept using.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that you're still innocent until proven guilty. So the board opens an investigation. And the investigation they're very backlogged with these investigations. I don't know any state board that isn't, just the one that I was at the time. But it took them 2 years to get to my case.
And did you get clean in the meantime?
Not immediately. I had trouble at that point in time. And I went to a couple AA meetings and I was still thinking I was different than everybody else because I was a nurse and a social worker. God.
Not just a nurse, but a nurse and a social worker.
So I'm better than these people.
Damn
Yeah, exactly. I kept using. I got in more trouble. I was arrested total 2 more times in 2 months. Once for theft, and then I got another job at another hospital because I was under investigation, which the public does. The public and the professional institutions do not know that you're under investigation. They just know about it once you're disciplined.
So you got a job.
So I got another job.
You disclosed that you were being investigated because there was no findings.
Right. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So I got another job, and I, again, swore I was not going to take any drugs from the hospital. That lasted, I think, about 6 hours into the new job when I was off of orientation.
Uh-huh.
And I stole drugs again. And then I went back, and I worked the rest of the week, and I had gotten arrested my first week at work there.
At work?
Nope, not yet.
Okay, for something else.
For something else, it was a theft charge regarding, I was high on Xanax and something else at the time. But anyway, that happened, and then, of course, because I got arrested again, I felt more guilt, more shame, blah, 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 blah. The using increased automatic, almost immediately.
Automatic response,
addict response. And, I was getting to a bottom, I guess, at that point, because when I took drugs the following week from the hospital, I took drugs not necessarily to get high, but to kill myself, because I didn't understand what was wrong with me at that point.
Right.
And
you left an obvious trail.
Well, yeah, I emptied the drawer. I mean, like, I didn't leave any left on the unit. I mean, I took it all.
Yeah. And you were just going to go home and kill yourself?
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the hospital realized it, changed the shift, and ended up calling the police, and the DEA was notified and all that other stuff, and a felony warrant was served about 20, they issued a felony warrant for my arrest. And the following, not the next morning, but the following morning, my door was broken down. There were folks with their guns ablazing, found me unconscious. I remember the guns ablazing because, they were trying to wake me up and there was two people standing there with guns, making sure I didn't hit anybody or something. Anyway,
you don't usually use guns with unconscious people, but I don't know, that's just me.
I think they were a little...
They didn't know what they were getting into with you?
No, and they knew that I was arrested for evading, so, I mean, they just didn't know. And plus, I think they were uneducated in terms of substance abuse. Anyway, we'll just leave that out, because that's... anyway,
you're trying to be politically correct here. I understand,
and it's not working.
No, let's just say
that they were very excited to be able to pull their guns.
Right, and it was unnecessary drama, violence,
mm-hmm.
whatever. Okay.
So they drugged me actually to the same ER where I stole the drugs from again, as a suicidal. Person that overdosed on these opiates stolen from the hospital, and they handcuffed me to a stretcher in the emergency room right by the nurse's station so everybody could see.
Mm-hmm. And was that their purpose?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Mm-hmm. So you were pretty humiliated?
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was that the bottom for you?
Yeah, I mean, because at that point, after they released me, they took me to jail, and I'm thinking it's another theft charge or something like that. But when I got to the hearing and they told me what the charge was, because that's the first time I had heard the charge, it was not evading. That was the last one. Fraudulent delivery of a Schedule II narcotic, and I was like, well, that sounds pretty serious. And then the judge looked at me and she said, bail is set at $100,000. I was like, okay, they're mad. They're getting for real with me at this point in time.
Yeah.
And I had friends that I had recently met in AA mm-hmm. that knew of my attorney and contacted him, and somehow I got out of jail within 3-4 days, where I was on suicide observation and all that other stuff. So undressed naked with a paper gown on for everybody to look at you in the, mm-hmm. it was very humiliating.
Yeah.
The whole thing was very humiliating. That's part of the deal.
So, and you've been recovering for how long?
I had 2.5 years, and now I'm coming up on 2 again.
Mm-hmm. So you had 2.5 years, and then you relapsed on
and
alcohol.
I drank one day. Yeah. And then
And then you've been clean since that time.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. And I left jail, went to rehab at that point in time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And was it a specialized rehab for professionals, or was it a rehab that was for anybody that had a problem?
I had called the nursing board,
the
diversion program, and they recommended this place to me.
Okay.
And it happened to be a lot of nurses and a lot of flight attendants and pilots.
Impaired professionals, you know, they often will do that, impaired professionals programs, or largely impaired professionals programs. So
I did 28 days there, and then I went to a halfway house because I lost...
You lost everything.
I lost everything because of that.
As the show title says.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I lost my apartment.
Jack loses everything. And he did.
Mm-hmm. I did. I lost the apartment. I mean, the car was taken, and I had to pay, but I was able to get it back eventually. Of course, I lost a significant other.
Yeah.
Only 8 months earlier, and it was because of my drug use. I wasn't talking to my family at the time. I mean, I was alone in a new city, and I had two people that I talked to still, and those were from AA that I didn't know very well.
Hmm. Yeah. And here you are. That was 4.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then aside from the relapse, 2 years, so 2 years of continuous sobriety. I guess my question is, do you have hope today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, my life is incredible, actually.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm able to live in my own skin. I'm able to work in my profession. And
have you cleaned up? Do you feel like you've done all the necessary, cleanup work, amends work, whatever you call it?
The big ones.
The big ones?
The big ones. I mean, in terms, for me, the big ones were direct people.
Yeah.
Ends up my ex is in recovery. Mm-hmm. And we have a friendship today that I never thought was possible. I'm in good standing with all of my family members.
And you're almost done with the program that you went through the board. You're almost done with that?
Correct.
You're within some months of completing that?
A few months, yeah.
And that's been a 4-year process? I mean, is that a 4-year program or?
No, it's a 2-year program.
Okay, but because of the relapse, it's taking somewhat longer.
Honestly, they don't know about the relapse.
Yeah.
Because the relapse happened the same time that the investigation was brought up and everything was happening. So the relapse was...
Oh, okay. So you had... Yeah, because you had explained to me it took 2 years for them to even start the whole thing, and you were working and staying clean that whole time.
Yes, and...
And when the investigation started, that's when...
Well, when the investigation came to a hearing, and they were not giving me credit, because I had an administrative attorney that was helping me with dealing with the board.
Yeah.
Because when you're under investigation, you need an attorney. If you're out there and you're a healthcare professional, get an attorney. Don't deal with the board yourself. and she had me on a drug monitoring call-in system, kind of like you do with the board once you're in their program. But she had me doing that randomly so I could prove sobriety because she knew how long the process could take. Had they put me into the program right away, I would have been...
You'd have been done 2 years ago.
Yes and no, and I guess it's all God's hands, because I had a whole journey I needed to go through, I think, before I started this program.
Right.
However, it's a program designed for newly sober folks.
Right.
Because...
Like, and then when you went to treatment, you had been sober for some time at that point, right?
Meaning?
You'd been clean by the time you went, when you started, didn't you go into like a rehab program for them?
For the nursing board?
Yeah.
Yes. And they needed, I had to go see a addiction specialist, and if they recommended treatment, I would have to go to treatment all over again, and what insurance company is going to pay for treatment when you've been sober for 2 years? You know what I'm saying?
Like, right.
That's just insane.
Right.
But it is what it is. I had to do what I had to do to keep my license.
Right, and you did.
I did.
So we probably have to put a wrap on this here now. So, you know, just by way of you know, conclusion, I'm glad to hear you have hope and you're back in the profession. You're doing what you love to do. You're doing what you're good at. Is there any other advice you would give to, you know, those professionals out there that, you know, either nurses or doctors or healthcare people, therapists, anybody who's beginning to take a look at their substance abuse problem and wonder what to do?
There's a lot of hope, and there is a lot of folks in the profession who are sober.
Mm-hmm. More than you know.
More than you know, because they don't talk about it at work.
Right.
I don't know if any of the folks that are sober, the physicians...
So what's the code? Is there a secret handshake or what?
Do you know what? There are actually, in the city where I live, there are actually several meetings focused on healthcare workers.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you find those?
I actually contacted a treatment center, and they gave me...
And so that you could go anonymously.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know there's meetings for pilots.
You know, specifically.
Special meetings for pilots, and there's meetings for... So there's meetings... And that's the way to do it. Contact a treatment center, and you can find it anonymously.
Yeah, that's how I found it. Yeah.
Okay.
Because they don't really publish it, and I don't see it in any magazines or anything like that. It's kind
specifically of, because it's not public.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, well, I really... is there anything else you would say? Anything else you would like to say to those folks out there that are thinking about it? Any other...
Even if you're supposed to know better, it doesn't mean you're not sick.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even though you're supposed to know better, it has nothing to do with knowing better, does it?
No.
You knew better and that didn't stop it?
Correct.
That wasn't it?
Yeah. So don't beat yourself up about it.
Yeah. It's a disease.
It's a disease.
Equal opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you, Jack, and I appreciate it. And I think we'll close with that. I want to thank our listeners, thank our studio audience for making us a successful underground support source for the recovering community. We'll email out reminders for next week's show, usually at the end of the week. And so remember to check recoveryinternetradio.com. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com.
For all our archive shows, sign up for our email reminder list. Remember, too, that we want to hear from you so we know where you are. As always, live today, love yourself and your neighbor, and together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and we'll see you at 8 o'clock next Sunday night. Thank you all.